Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Unfiltered Finance with Ron and John. As always, I'm joined by my friend and esteemed partner, Ron Geffner. My name is John D'Agostino, and we're here to look at technology, finance, and legal topics in an understandable, hopefully interesting way. Ron?
You know what? Sometimes I can't really improve upon perfection there, John, but I'll try. So we have a really interesting guest on a subject that has definitely gotten me freaked out. And that's actually very relevant and current. And John knows Scott obviously better than I would. So I'm going to allow John to introduce Scott. And then if it's okay, I want to sort of segue into something more topical, and then we'll get into the background that Scott has.
Great. Well, Dr. Scott Stornetta is a friend and also someone I respect greatly. He's a very humble individual, largely considered to be one of the fathers of modern blockchain science, along with he always gives wonderful credit to his esteemed partners in that endeavor. Also renowned on the artificial intelligence side, just who is fortunate enough to be in the prime of his career, who is still building and still solving real wonderful problems. So Scott and I also, it was wonderful. We just published an article together on his latest company slash investment, SureMark. And we're gonna talk today about sort of what led us to this point where the very definition of reality and truth can reasonably be questioned through cheap means and very commercially available means, what that means for really everything. And how SureMark and other solutions are looking to forestall the inevitable demise of truth. Scott, I hope that was a sufficient introduction, but please, I'd love to just get a quick intro on you and kind of what you think is relevant in terms of your background to share with the audience.
Happy to do that, but I can't even start without responding to your quip. It's not the demise of truth, it's the demise of reality.
Fair enough.
We're going to redefine reality. Right. But Scott Stornetta, and I feel like I've been at the right place at the right time twice in my life. Once when I met my wife, her future wife, and secondly, when I had the rare opportunity to be part of the Bell Labs research tradition, where you had just some of the brightest minds in the world across all different disciplines aggregated together. And that allowed two of us to work on a problem that we considered truly monumental, namely how to create immutable digital records. Now, people don't necessarily use that language anymore. They talk about what they call the blockchain, but it's the idea of involving such a wide variety of participants that you can make records immutable and without the need to trust the creator of the records or the maintainer. So that's a little of my background. I guess the other half, since we're going to be talking about AI and deepfakes, is that my dissertation from Stanford was, I believe, the first neural networks focused PhD that they issued. So I sort of sit in both the cryptography and blockchain space, but also have kept a toe in the water in the AI space for many years.
Scott, did you expect, did you see when ChatGPT was released, it was like this thunderbolt that struck lay people, I would say. But I have spoken to friends of mine who either work in the lab at MIT or work in certain deep tech places like you did at Bell Labs, and they were slightly less surprised. I mean, they were all impressed. It was an impressive release. But were you less surprised by than the normal lay person as to what we saw when ChatGPT was opened up?
I suppose a little less so, simply because I had seen prior generations that weren't so startling incrementally get developed and built. And so it's still a transformational technology, societal level transformational technology, but not entirely surprised about how it's played out.
So what you mentioned deepfake, I want to start to get the audience in line. If you can explain in a user-friendly manner what a deep fake is. And then I want to switch to, I don't know if you saw, and pardon for the language, the fuck Kanye video for him being anti-Semitic that's been circulating the internet the last few days. And that is a deep fake. So it's gone from stories I've heard, cautionary tales, where one or two clients heard from a client who heard from a client, somebody being involved and manipulated by a deep fake, to now something that we're seeing with more and more routine on the internet, and not knowing what, as you said, what is real and what is not real. So why don't you just, since you talk about it far more than I do,
sure,
introduce deep fake and what, how it's been evolving.
Happy to. Again, a word that anyone is familiar with that de-technologizes it is impersonation. And when you see something online that purports to be one person, but in fact did not involve their participation, their authorization, then you're talking about being impersonated. And what has changed so dramatically is that so much of our interaction is now digital. We're in a Zoom conference call, whereas 20 years ago, we would have been meeting all together in a studio for an event like this. We trade emails with people. We basically, our interactions between humans are taking place increasingly in a digital realm. And in a digital realm, because computers have become so powerful, it's possible to alter the images or the sound or the video or the writings of someone without it at all being clear how they were altered, and yet they still look highly realistic or sound highly realistic. Okay. So it's really just an example of technology turning up the knob on impersonation. And that's what I more broadly would call a deep fake. And the real, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, don't stop, please.
And the real issue is, I see that you have an SEC background, and I can very much appreciate where you're coming from that. The real issue is one of the more frivolous and famous deepfakes that appeared early on in this era was showing the Holy Father, the Pope, in a very puffy white parka. Okay. We all saw that and got a giggle out of it. But it didn't really change anything. The problem you have is when you have market-moving information that turns out to be false, that turns out to be impersonated. And if I could just offer one example that admittedly broadens what we mean by deepfake, but we had Chairman Gensler of the SEC, whose Twitter become X account was hacked. And someone published a purported press release, press announcement, that certain ETFs had been approved. This was just last February. Now, that immediately was market-moving information. And it was perhaps 30 minutes or an hour later that the SEC IT people were able to recover control of the account and post that this was an inaccurate press release and so forth. But for the people that made trades based on the news, assuming it was the official news from Chairman Gensler, that's a material impact that deepfakes are having. Now, many people would more narrowly define deepfake to say just a fancy manipulation of a photo or a video or an audio track. But that's why I think it's better to talk about we're moving into a much more digital world. Much more of our interactions are digital. And impersonation is the problem. Someone purporting to be one person, but in fact, not being that person. And us acting on, assuming the information is true and acting on that information, that from puffy parkas to market moving events, there's a big transition there.
And I'll offer, just based on the luxury of having very deep conversations with Scott as we were writing this article together, I'll offer something, Scott, and I'm curious if you agree or not. So when I think of what's the difference between this term deepfake, what it represents and why it scares people, and I think, well, look, the technology to manipulate photo and video has been there for a long time, right? It's been, Photoshop has been around for decades, yet photographic evidence is still generally considered valid. It's used in courts of law. So why did Photoshop not have such a sea change as we see AI coming? So for me, the term deepfake is valid if it applies to two characteristics of manipulation. One, first and foremost, is who can do it, right? Photoshop manipulation, there's a limited number of people in the world who can do high quality photographic, there's a limited number of people in the world who can paint a Monet realistic enough to fool an art gallery. So it's the commodification of what previously was very, very rare skill. And then for the second characteristic, I would say it's multivariable. So it's not just that you make a photo look like Scott, it's you can actually have a conversation. And if you don't know Scott, maybe he can fool you because the AI can scrape enough of what Scott said and wrote to emulate a layer one veneer of Scott. So those two things are as different as I would say Napster was. You know, when I was a kid, I would copy tapes. I'd put the radios together, I'd hit play and record, right? So you could copy music forever, but you couldn't do 100,000 streams at once. That Napster forced an entire industry to change. I think that's the thing. It's the commodification of a rare and expensive skill set, and then multivariable reality distortion. That's how I see deepfake. Scott, what do you think about that?
I'm happy to talk about that. You say commodification. I would almost call it democratization. Okay. Anyone has access, and I know I'm flipping the script on the denotations of certain words and their connotations. It's the every man or every person principle when it comes to being able to manipulate data without any real expertise. But it also goes to the volume as a result. These techniques are becoming essentially zero cost. Okay. And that is going to greatly amplify the volume of cases. And that goes back to, I'm afraid it was Stalin that I associate with, quantity has a quality all its own. And when you have 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe a million times more data that's flooding the internet that's fake, it changes the equation. And the fact that it is becoming ever more realistic at an ever decreasing cost means that we have to reassess how we confirm who we are, how we identify ourselves. And that, I think, is the real risk of deepfake.
So you mentioned commoditization, democratization, each having their own nuanced meanings as positive or negative, quite frankly. And we mentioned Gensler from last February. We mentioned the fuck Kanye video that's going around this week. Is there any statistic you're aware of that shows the frequency in which this is occurring? I don't want to presume, but it seems to be the case. It's on an uprise.
Yes.
And right now it seems to be an issue for certain high profile people. And we talk about the democratization of people that can do it, but at what point will it be commoditized or democratized where it might affect more the day-to-day uses for people. Is there any data there?
I think one way to try to quantify, and I don't have a great statistic for what you've asked, though I have seen many, it's just that I don't trust any of them, is when the cost to impersonate becomes low enough, then it's no longer just celebrities that are financially worth it to be a target. And what I'm talking about is, I think people are familiar, many people are familiar with the so-called grandmother scams. One in particular that I'm thinking of, which my own mother almost fell for, is when they get a phone call and it says, "Grandma, this is such and such grandson, okay, and I'm in jail and I need bail, and please don't tell my mom." Okay, so cutting off the ability for them to verify. And so you get my mother, grandmother to my children, in this awkward situation where they feel like it's a desperate situation, there's no way to verify it, and so they want to err on the side of paying the money. Now, as you move into this is a growing problem even before AI, but now as you move into this commodification where anyone can create this fake persona that sounds like the grandson or the granddaughter, based on just a few seconds worth of their voice, then suddenly this is everybody's problem and not just Taylor Swift's or Kanye's or the Pope's.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Ron, I agree with you, Ron. That data would be useful. And I like Scott. I've seen some numbers, and who knows if they're real or not. But I think where Scott's going, and I agree with this, is like risk is the probability of an event occurring multiplied by the severity of that event. And right. So let's say, for example, right now, let's say Scott, this isn't Scott, right? Let's say this is a AI rendering of Scott. It would be embarrassing for you and I, Ron. But like ultimately, there's like, what's the consequence of it? Right? We probably have a good story. But let's say Scott and I were closing on an apartment. I'm buying a co-op right now, so it's on my mind. If Scott and I are closing on an apartment and I'm going to wire a substantial portion of my wealth to him, knowing that it's possible for that not to be Scott, I'm going to need some type of mechanism to ensure it. I'm not going to risk it. It's like, sometimes low probability events change our behavior, right? There's a 0.001% or roughly of getting eaten by a shark, but it changes how we think about going in the water.
Yeah,
especially if you saw the movie Jaws.
It's a binary event for the person that gets eaten by the shark.
although there was a kayaker that did get swallowed by a whale this past week, and the whale spit him up moments later. So, I might tend to disagree.
We think there was, Ron. We saw a video that there was, This may be a great segue, but that kayaker did not verify the video and say, in fact, yep, that actually happened. And nobody told us that kayaker is a real person. So I could not imagine a better segue, Scott. You know the video we're talking about? There's a video going around right now. It's amazing, of a dad. You saw it, right? So what a great segue into what Shermark could possibly do. Let's even use that video as sort of a MacGuffin for this discussion, because that's a great example. How do we know that actually happened? How could we ever prove it? The whale's not talking.
Right. And I guess I would just make a bit of a straw man argument to highlight the direction that Shermark is taking. And that is, as it becomes more and more difficult to distinguish between a fully synthesized artificial video and one that is accurately capturing something that happened in the physical world, the issue becomes not so much, is this real or fake, but who is willing to stand behind this? Who is willing to stake their reputation and say, I endorse this as, I stake my reputation in saying that this event or that this video actually reflects the reality of the event. And that's why we've shifted the focus in AI deepfake detection from using some algorithm to try to distinguish between real or not real, and instead shifted it over to, are we confident that this person is claiming endorsement, claiming, putting their reputation on the line, saying, yes, this represents reality and I'm signing off on it. It's not unlike a political radio spot. You know, you get to the end of the 30-second spot and they say, I'm John so-and-so and I endorsed this ad. And I raise it in the political context in part because whether what's said in the ad is actually true in a political setting is highly questionable. But the issue is not what John so-and-so said, whether it can be documented. It's whether John so-and-so is taking responsibility for saying those things or not. And I think we're going to move to a world, and this is why I tried to be a little bit glib about it's not truth that we're after, it's redefining reality. As we see more and more synthetic things in with real things, things that we're used to seeing, it's less about whether the video bits have been altered and more about who is staking their reputation. Who is at the end of this chain of provenance? Who is staking their reputation that this is something they've endorsed? This is something that they are putting their money where their mouth is.
So that deals with, that deals with reputational risk or damage. And obviously in many situations, it's quite an important subject matter. But when you're looking at flipping how to deal with a situation, does that mean for financial fraud, like the grandmother scenario we talked about where grandson Timmy calls from jail and says, Grandma, don't tell Mom. But what happens when it's a video call? What happens when it's an audio call? Are there any, whether it's Shoremark or some other person, it's in real time, are there any other things that are in the works that you are aware of, other than creating mechanisms where I have to call you back? You know, tell me the secret password that we've come up with. I mean, I know that there are other ways to protect, but it's also like Mike Tyson, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face. When you're the recipient of this and all the chips are down and you're freaked out because the person sounds freaked out, you may not go to the protocols. So I'm just trying to get to that as well.
Well, I agree that it's a concern that you should have, but in a sense, the solution is to have a protocol that is so easy to use that you don't feel like it's burdensome to do it every time. And if you have something that's seamless, then it just becomes part of the natural flow. And so to me, this is not so much about the mathematics, which we sweat the details on, but it's also about just the human ease of use. If it becomes something that's effectively automatic and accepted, then we don't have to ask whether we need to escalate up to this level. We just say, okay, we know for a fact that this is who they say they are.
And this is super important, Ron. We entitled our article The Reality Coefficient. And that name, that term, it's a kind of a cute term, but it comes from originally when Scott and I first started talking about, let's do an article together. The original idea was, are there ways for what Scott's doing and what Shoremark's doing to even a bigger goal, which is to potentially reduce the wealth gap? with the assumption that part of the wealth gap problem is this divide between the haves and the have-nots vis-a-vis technology. And so the original title of the article was like using AI and using these techniques to reduce the Gini coefficient. And then we realized, all right, maybe it's too big of a problem to tackle in this article. And let's just define it a derivative of that, which is this idea of the reality coefficient, right? We already have a problem. We know this, that poorer people don't have access to internet as much as wealthier people. And that's an issue in the world. AI is going to compound that issue because the people who have access to this technology will be able to manipulate and control and gain power even faster. So this a whole notion was like, are there cheap, simple solutions so that a poor individual has the ability to control their identity to some degree, as well as a Hollywood superstar? That's where the term reality coefficient came from.
Right. It's easy to establish the identity of a Taylor Swift, okay? Because she has a bevy of attorneys surrounding her that will force deep fakes to be taken down under penalty of something. And to use her association to make it easy to know when you're meeting with the real Taylor Swift. But when it gets down to the granularity or down to the level where you're talking about ordinary people, people that don't have millions of followers, they can gain these same protections that we're affording these other people.
Ron, I'm not sure if you're on mute, but it's an extraordinarily elegant solution, because the way I think about it, and I have a tendency to oversimplify these things that Scott comes up with, but the way I think about it is it's leveraging this extraordinary technology of blockchain, which one thing it does really well is it kind of allows for organizing people, large groups of people, through they vote with their transactions. Their will is expressed through transactions, and you pretty much know that's what they meant to do. So it organizes that sentiment and quantifies it to some degree into this hash, into this mark. And so it's kind of like being able, when you meet somebody for the first time, Ron, what do you do when you meet someone, right? You Google them, check their LinkedIn out, right? And we've come now to get to a point where, like, if there's nothing about them on the internet, we're a little worried. But we've gotten a sense of like how to gauge. But the best thing, of course, is if I know five friends who know that person and I get five of them who I trust to say, yeah, they're a good guy, you know, 98% of my diligence is done as to whether this is a good person that I can trust, right? That's it. That's all I need. So imagine you could theoretically do that and get that level of confidence for anyone in the world, as if you've called five of your friends and they said, look, I'm not going to say the guy never lies, but generally, they're a good person. They are who they say they are. They're not like a complete con man. There's enormous power behind that.
Right. What the phrase we use is, you prove who you are by showing who you know. And we've found a way, again, to commodify that, to democratize that, to digitize that. We can do it without having to get biometric information about a person. We can do it without needing to check their passport or their government issued ID or driver's license or whatever. We can prove who they are by anchoring it in a deep network of who they know. And this interlinked web of trust, if you will, is what grounds an individual into who they are. And then having done that, we can credentialize that and allow them to essentially sign off on any digital content that's produced, or sign off at the beginning of a audio or video call. So it really is two steps. It's making sure that the person that gets this credential is the person they claim they are, and then make it easy to use this credential. That's the leveling process.
Ron, as an attorney, I'm sure your mind is kind of spinning and thinking how this might be useful in courts of law, both in terms of proving that certain video evidence is actually you, but also, quite frankly, casting doubt upon whether non-marked video evidence is you.
Well, there are never-ending issues. Two of you are focused, which I understand, on the high profile, the bigger issue. Where my head is actually going, it's 5 years from now, the technology continues to get commercialized. It's predominantly marketed to people doing videos on some platform, and you want to have the ability to manipulate it. Like, I think of Snapchat and all the facial features you can do, and now all the different overlays we can do on video calls to change the entire background. So I see it going more towards entertainment, and then they have enhanced versions, and now you have the bad people using it and buying it. I probably get no less than 2 spam texts daily. If it's not EasyPass, it's somebody who claims that they have my name and number in their book, in their address book or their contact list. So in my head, it's more going to my relationship. My concern is my relationship with my clients, meaning transactions they may enter into. We've seen it already with audio. We had a situation in which somebody contacted a client of ours, posing to be a client of the client, had all the data, sounded exactly like the person that they had known for a period of time. They had tapped into all the correspondence, they hacked it, and they tried to engage in a financial transaction. And we'll leave it there. It's not the first time we're hearing it. It's the first time I heard it was via phone call, as opposed to you call somebody up and you know they're on an airplane, you call one of their associates or colleagues to get a wire ad on a deal that has to get done that moment, and they know they can't reach their colleague on the airplane. So it's getting more and more aggressive. It still isn't primary, it's not prime time. Like I said, you hear it from somebody, hears it from somebody. It's one of those urban legends. But I'm hearing more urban legends occurring. And when I saw the Kanye video, while it touched me on an emotional level because of my political and positioning on it, and value positioning on it, it's a sign that I better expect this sea of change, that we're going to expect it more and more. And I used to find it funny, but when I put my lawyer hat on, I'm seeing all the consequential effect it has.
And again, another way to come at this, I very much agree with what you're saying. In engineering circles, they talk about the signal to noise ratio. And what it means is, am I getting a clear signal or is it highly staticky? Okay. And you want the signal, the clear signal, to be as strong as it can be relative to all the noise in the background. And what's happening is the amount of noise is rising. And what we want is to find a way to flip the script on that so that you're getting the clear signal again. And that's really what the effort here is about, making it easy to get the clear signal. And by doing that, you don't force every deepfake to go away, but you're disarming the deepfake, because people know to look for the Surmark credential. You're making the deepfake less relevant. It's not that you have to disprove it at every stage. It's that, I mean, if I could switch to a different example, a great advertising campaign is the Carfax advertising campaign of about 10 years ago, where it just became, why would you even think of buying a car if you can't check the Carfax? And in a sense, what's happening here is we're not trying to defeat a deepfake. We're trying to make it something lost in the noise because it doesn't have the clear Surmark signal, doesn't have the credential. And in that way, it doesn't matter how many deepfakes get manufactured. They just become less and less relevant.
Scott, I think of it as exactly that. I think of it as you're trying to arm or provide nutrition for our natural instincts and skepticism. That's kind of how I think about it, right? So if I live in New York City, I've gotten people walk up and people walk up and they try to scam you, and you make there's a very human response. You look them up and down, you look at your environment, you consider the time of day where you are, and you come to an intuitive decision: is this person really need my help, or are they a con artist? And some people are more cynical and some people are more trusting, but we all have this intuition. And I think the problem, to Ron's point, is what I'm seeing in the scam calls I'm getting is, maybe I'm arrogant, but up until about 3 or 4 years ago, I'll be honest, when I heard people got scammed by phone scams and email scams, I kind of judged them. I kind of like, this is all, I can see through this in a second.
It's never going to happen.
I probably was wrong about that.
How naive could these people be?
How naive. And I think that's wrong, because I do think, depending, if not for the grace of God, there go I. But I was a little bit judgmental. Recently, I'm getting attempts that I'm like, wow, like I'm seeing for the first time, they might have, if I had a bad day. I'll tell you a very quick story. I have a friend, she's an incredibly successful entrepreneur, tough as nails, smarter than me. And one day I get a random phone call and she's crying. She had just given birth. I mean, like 2 weeks before. And she was crying and she's like, I can't reach my husband, you have to help me. And I'm like, what's wrong? And I owe money to the IRS. And it was that classic IRS scam. They're on the other line, they're gonna arrest me. And I won't use her name, I won't embarrass her, but I was like, Jennifer, stop, think. And she was crying and she was hysterical. And then I screamed at her. I remember something, I screamed at the top of my lungs, stop and think. And then literally just, she paused and went, oh my God, and hung up. And we spoke later, and I kind of gave her some crap. I was like, how could you fall for that? And she's like, John, I just gave birth. It was like the confluence of events, and I don't blame her. She was going through something I could never imagine. So my point is, that's, I think, what you had to be in that state of mind if you were kind of savvy. Now I don't know for sure anymore. I think I could be a victim. I really do. So I see what you're doing as giving us back that immunity, if you will, giving us back the another variable that we can use good strong intuition to not be in that situation.
Yeah, and again, what I find interesting about it myself is that we're turning it, this highly digitized age, in a sense, we're turning it into a small town community feel. Because if you're in a small town and everybody knows everybody and you only meet face to face, there's a natural reason that you learn who to trust whom. Well, I know this person because I know their mom, or I know their brother, or I know the person that works with them, whatnot. And what we're doing is we're leveraging that network of trust in a way that we can commoditize it. In a way that we can commoditize it and automate it, so that you can have that hometown, small town feel of trust about the people you're interacting with, even if you've never met them before.
Okay, Ron, unless you have another question on the theory behind it, I maybe love to spend the next 10 minutes or so talking about the how. Like, how do you get a sure mark? How does it work?
I'd love to hear the how.
Great. So Scott, let's say, so how, and this is your company, so obviously you're going to talk about your process, but walk us through like how a regular person, let's assume they're savvy enough to use their iPhone, but that's about it. Don't know what blockchain is, can't work with a decentralized exchange, doesn't know what tokens are. How could your average savvy tech millennial engage with a company like SureMark and protect themselves?
Well, I'd start with, how do they verify other sources? Not them as a source, but the people that they follow and that they depend on. And the answer there really goes to simply, there's a free download that they can use that works inside Safari or Chrome or whatever, that allows them to do the verification side of things. if they're a content creator, there's a little more to it. But as the recipient of information, trying to decide whether this is real or fake for someone important to them, it's as simple as a free download that doesn't cost anything to use that performs this check on the other person's network. And in that sense, I don't know if people are old enough to remember, but there was a point in time, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where if you went to a particular website, there was one of two icons displayed, either an open lock or a closed padlock. And the closed padlock meant this is a HTTPS, a secured website. And the open padlock meant this this website is not necessarily registered in any official way. And all that SureMark is doing, in a sense, is instead of it being on a per website basis, it's on a per video or per phone call or per written communication basis. So we're atomizing it down to the level of, regardless of what website this appeared on or what mechanism I'm using to communicate with this person, is this particular phone call authentic? Is this particular video authentic? And so we're really just providing that closed lock icon. It's as simple as that.
And it has to be simple because in some sense this is amazing. But as you're speaking, Scott, I'm thinking, what an exhausting existence we're heading for, where every minutia of every interaction has to be trusted, it has to be questioned, and it, you know, and it's going to have to be something that just becomes natural, because yeah. I can just see people getting exhausted, right? It just, I don't care if I get scammed. I'm sick of questioning everything.
Right. It has to happen in the background. It has to happen seamlessly. And it has to be drop dead easy to use. It has to be just a simple visual signal that you can have confidence in, because you're in control of the verify, or the tool that you use is in control of the verify.
Can I just go back to the stats? Obviously, you whether it's the investment, your involvement with SureMark, the stats show in your mind, or the other data shows that there's a demand for what it is you're doing. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. So, and John, I hear you that there'll become apathy and just sure tired, being worn down by the volume of the need. And if it's okay, I just wanted to go back to, how do you see, you don't see this proliferating, Scott? You just assume, I shouldn't say assume, you've concluded that by virtue of verifying the things you put out there, if something's out there and it's not verified from you, your audience will know, well, look, there's 50 verified, there's 5 unverified, that should be enough. But all of a sudden, if there are 50 verified and 500 unverified, at what point do people lose, like, is it like a sand on a beach, a grain of sand?
I actually think of it the other way around. Namely, let's go back to the Gary Gensler situation. Okay. If people with a vested financial interest in the markets know that Gary Gensler is a source of market moving information, or, you know, Jerome Powell, whoever you want to say, then they're going to say, it's worth it for me to know that it's verified. Okay. And so to me, it's not about the deluge of fake overwhelming. It's about the deluge of fake becoming irrelevant. Why should I even open this email if it's not from someone that I can validate? Why even bother?
That's a great point, Ron. I mean, the problem we're all going to have with our lives is how to filter how to make decisions about what to absorb. Right? We don't have time to absorb everything. And so if this takes off and this becomes trusted, I could see this becoming a really good filter, right? You open your inbox, there's 1,000 emails, right? You miss a day and there's 1,000 emails. I would sort them by who has a sure mark. I would start with, you know, who do I know is to, before I get to like going through all my spam and deciding if something is spam or not. So I think this is going to be, you know, this or whatever solution that can ensure that the person sending the video or whatnot is actually the person they're claimed to be, is a great way, at least one variable in this filter we're all going to have to build. Otherwise, how the hell can we get through our day given the volume that's going to be coming at us, that already is coming at us?
Now let me say something that undercuts the whole thesis that you're putting out. Namely, that this must be a big enough market for me to be interested in it and, you know, to invest time and money. And I have to say, and I hope, tongue in cheek, my investors aren't listening, but to me, I'm driven to initially solve a problem because I think it's an important problem. And I would feel somehow incomplete if I didn't render the solution. That's how it worked for the blockchain. In other words, it wasn't someone saying, if you invent immutable records, I'll give you a lot of money. It's, if we don't invent immutable records, there will be a kind of hole in the universe that just shouldn't be there. And that's the way I feel about unforgeable identities. There should be a way to have a normal and natural world without having to constantly question who I'm interacting with. And until that hole in the universe is plugged, I'm the kind of person that just can't go on with life.
Can we join hands and say amen, please? I agree with you. I'm very much a person of equity and fairness and balance and safety. So I definitely identify with your perspective on the world and making it a better place, irrespective of economic gain.
It doesn't mean that to have impact, it doesn't need to find a viable economic path, but I guess I separate it into two stages. First, I'm incomplete until I feel like I have a solution to a problem. And then I have to ask myself, it's not about becoming, you know, generating great wealth about it, but it's about having impact. And the only way to have impact, okay, in a self-sustaining way is to build a profitable business. And when I say the only way, what I mean is something has to sustain itself so that it can grow in its influence. And if it's just a one-shot thing, it hasn't achieved its effect. And so to me, it's how do you increase the impact for good? And when you create value like that, profit flows in a natural way so that you can reinvest and make it even better.
And you know, we're talking about a system that relies on, at its core, human referrals. And, you know, that's kind of what's going to happen here, because Ron doesn't know you. I'm sure he's got a sense for you from this conversation, but Ron knows me for 20 years. And when I tell Ron, this isn't just BS. This isn't just what, you know, entrepreneurs are supposed to say about loving the process. I've gotten to know Scott well enough that I'm very confident this is 1,000,000% genuine. Ron will believe me and therefore believe you that this is actually genuine, what you're saying. I will say you're lucky that you've chosen an idea with a TAM of everyone, literally everyone in the world, in theory, will need this. Many people may decide not to leverage it because, you know, we make decisions all the time about what to, maybe we don't buy insurance when we should, et cetera, et cetera. But I struggle to see how, I think about my daughters, assuming it was priced effectively, I struggle to see a world where whatever percent of their income, it's not a good idea to have it go towards something where they can point to the veracity of their identity within a document. That seems a really, really smart move. I'm thinking about like even kids where it's like, you know, they get bullied because there's some deep fake video going around that some jerk bully made of my daughter. And, you know, at a minimum, again, you can't disprove it's not her. Oh, you can't prove it's not her, but you can cast doubt on it because she's tagged her other videos and she hasn't tagged that. So it's just that's as a parent, I'd pay for that in a second. Right. So yeah, I think your TAM is pretty big, but I can vouch for Scott's genuine nature of what he's talking about.
Yeah, either it solves the problem or it doesn't, and I want it to solve in a way that's lasting. That is not some cat and mouse game of ever.
No, understood that you create a technology and then somebody else comes up with the next layer to bypass your technology, and it's constantly a tit for tat. Understood.
Okay. But the last few minutes, so we covered the free browser extensions that you can use the ShoreMark network to see if stuff is marked or not. Just quickly kind of walk us through, like, let's say I decide to pay for this service. Let's say I want to get a ShoreMark and I want to start using it. Again, I'm a non-technical iPhone savvy layperson. I'm not a professional content creator. But let's say it's me. I'm John D'Agostino. There's several dozen YouTube videos of me speaking at various things. I've got my pictures on websites. How would I use ShoreMark operationally? What would I do to tag those things?
You want to lock it down. You want to lock those things down, so to speak. And all you do is you first go through this maybe a 1 minute process of creating your credential. And then you enhance your credential by having other credential holders that can essentially endorse you, say that you're the real John D'Agostino. And then once you have that identity established, it's as simple as you see a video or an image that comes up, or your follower base sends you a heads up on a video or image that comes up, and you can not only mark it, say, yeah, that is me, or that's not me, but you can also add secure commentary. So, for example, suppose you're interviewed in a podcast. I don't know if either of you have any familiarity with what a podcast is like. Oh, wait a minute. We're in a podcast. suppose something I say is taken a little out of context. But when that podcast is posted, what I can do is I can tag it and I can add my own secure commentary to it so that anyone that bothers to download the free extension can see what I had to say about that. And so I'm really protecting myself reputationally. I'm protecting my brand, and it's really two stages. You get the credential and then you start using it to sign off on things. And letting those that care about you, that follow you, I'm saying care not in a familial sense, but those that think your words matter, just say, download the free extension, you know, one time, and then from then on, you'll know it's me.
So, for example, if I were to say, Scott just said I'm the smartest person he's ever met, and someone were to clip that without the context of me now explaining you didn't actually say that. I would hate for someone to do that, by the way. Please don't do that if you're watching this. Yeah. And post that everywhere. You, in a secure manner, could go on and say, oh, I like John, but I actually didn't say that. So it's not just verifying that you were, in fact, on this podcast. It's giving you the ability to correct the record. And that's then right. Us knowing that it was Scott who corrected the record.
I was there on the podcast, but maybe taken a little out of context. What I actually said was John is one of the smartest people I've ever met. And
oh, Ron, I fished for that and I got one. That was pretty good.
You got him.
That's a different kind of fishing that I'm seeing.
Yeah. All right. Very cool. I want to thank our guest, Scott Stornetta. Those of you who are going to watch this podcast more, I try to be unbiased when interviewing people. I think my affection and my admiration for Scott probably came through on this a little bit too much. But unabashedly, I'm one of his references. So big fan. Scott, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for joining us, Scott. We enjoyed the conversation.
I hope that people, when this is posted, will check that Ron and Scott and John have all signed off on this.
Yes. Yes, we're going to do that. We're going to do that, and we're going to eat our dog food and make sure we do this. Scott, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Scott.
Really was.
Cheers.
Thank you.